War?
Yes.
French Lick, Indiana.
I say.
We were down there with the Cubs. And we couldn't go down to spring training, so we went to French Lick, Indiana. And then the following year, we went to Terre Haute. And then by that time, the war was over, and we went back to Pasadena.
I see. So that means you trained in French Lick in 43 and 44, and then Terre Haute in 45,
or did you
go back to Pasadena?
Yeah, I think we were down there around 42, 43, somewhere around there.
I see.
In 45, I think we went back to the coast, Pasadena.
I see.
Yeah.
Do you have any interesting stories about spring training up north?
Spring training down there?
Right.
The only thing I remember about French Lick was that they had the bass down there, and we took the baths. We couldn't get outside very much. It was cold. We had snow. And then we had a flood. The water was almost up to the, it was up to two steps on the front. And our field got underwater.
Did you have to go inside as a result?
We worked out in the auditorium. And we shared the other field with the Cubs. They went out in the morning about 10 o'clock, and they stayed out there till 1. Then we went out at 1, stayed till about 3:30 or quarter of 4.
Was this out of college? Was it a college field house? Or?
No, just a big auditorium in the hotel, the French Lick Hotel.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. We wore sneakers. It wasn't very good.
I believe in 1945, the White Sox hired a fellow named Carl Scheel to be a bench jockey. Carl Scheel.
Oh, he came out of the service.
Tell me about him.
Well, he was just a batting practice pitcher.
I see.
He was a great needler.
Uh-huh.
And he was on the bench, and he used to needle these guys, and he really got into the skill, especially the Browns. Luke Sewell was managing the Browns at the time, and one night down there, we got into a real brawl.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We got down in there, we started to battle on the bench. And
had he been a fan at one time?
No, I didn't know anything about him at all. He just came there. He's a batting practice pitcher, and he could get the ball over the plate, and we were just carrying him as a batting practice pitcher. He came out of the service, and we got in this battle underneath in the old dugout in St. Louis, which is very small, and they come out. They wanted him. And I'm trying to protect him, and he told me to get out of the way. So some guy come in, and he had been in the Marine Corps. He just threw him over his shoulder and down on that concrete like nobody's business. And he told me afterwards, he said, Jim, if I wanted to be nasty, I could have broke his arm. Because he says, I've been in the Marine Corps, and I know all about those colds and everything else. Carretti, or whatever they call it. Yeah. And he says, I could have killed him. But anyhow, it was all over. Sewell was the leader. He came over, and yeah, he got fined $500, and three or four of them got $200 or $300. And they never bothered our group at all.
And I understand that the Browns, the wartime Browns, were a rough, tough bunch.
No, they were a good guy, bunch of guys. They had a few guys on there that were I would say, didn't take particularly good care of themselves, but they were all, the guys were all right. But he got under their skin. George Kessler, I remember him. He was pitching. He took the ball. They would needle him so much, he took the ball and threw it into the dugout.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he threw it in there and didn't do any good. Of course, couldn't hit anybody. And the umpire was Art Passarella. And I went up to him and I said, how long are you going to stake this? He says, well, I can't do anything about it. I said, yes, you can. You can throw him out of the ball game. Well, the kid kept it up anyhow. Shield, first thing you know that they jumped us. They came over, but it didn't last long. It was all fights, and nobody got really hurt.
Okay, was the incident with Castor related to the fight? I mean,
yes, yeah.
Okay.
That was earlier, inning earlier.
Oh,
I see. When I went up to complain, a couple of innings later, I went up to complain to Passarella, and they just. When I started walking back to the dugout, they just came over and challenged him. But Carl would, as he told me, I got broke his arm. He threw him on the, I forget who it was, he just put him over his shoulder, and down he went on the concrete. He knew all the holes and everything else. He just came out of the Marine Corps. He was tough. Nice kid, though, very quiet. Never said anything off the ball field at all. But on the ball, he just had one of those voices that penetrated, and it just kept hitting on the ear, and it just gets to the point where they got mad at him, and then they challenged us, and didn't last long as usual. And Sewell, of course, he got fined $500 because he led the charge, and he was burnt up because I didn't get fined.
Uh-huh.
No reason for me getting fined. I was just in there defending it, was all.
Mm-hmm. I see. Being manager of the club, I suppose that you had to put up with a lot of headaches as far as travel restrictions and food rationing was concerned.
Oh.
Do you have any interesting stories about the train rides during the war?
Well, the only thing we did was we came into Philadelphia, and we were to go to Detroit, and this fellow was named McAllister was in charge of our transportation here in Philly. He was a railroad man, and he said that he couldn't get the cars for us. So I called up a vice president of the Pennsylvania Railroad, and I told him I understood fairly well, and that Landis had said there would be no favors or anything else. But I said, all we want is two cars. We got to get to Detroit. And I said, he wants the games to go on, and the president has okayed them. So I called him up, and he says, well, I'll call you back in about a half an hour. He called me back in about a half an hour, and he said the trains, the Pullmans will be for you on the train going out of North Philadelphia. That was the only time we had any trouble with it. Of course, we had to stand up a lot of times between Washington and Philadelphia. The trains were crowded, and there were no seats, and we couldn't get any Pullman cars because there wasn't any on there. And we always rode in chair cars, but during the war, we couldn't get any chair cars. And just get on and hope to get a seat, that was all. Otherwise, some of them had to stand from New York. I think we went from Philadelphia to Boston. Some of them had to stand all the way. They just couldn't find a seat. Well, I'd say until I got to New York. And a lot of them got off of New York, and then they grabbed those seats as quickly as they could. Otherwise, if they had to stand all the way from Philadelphia to Boston. It was really no inconvenience at all. We traveled just the same. We didn't have the same, comforts. We just got on, and that was it. And the railroad people, they couldn't do anything because Landis had issued an order there'd be no favors to anybody. We abided by that all the time.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about the Bellotta ball in 1943? It was a dead ball for a few months, and then they suddenly activated.
Oh, they put in the dead ball. They could hit that a mile. It wouldn't go anywhere. They'd hit it hard. Center fielders used to play him back at second base. They just couldn't get it, and then they figured that they'd have to get rid of that. So they went back to the old ball, a natural ball.
I was interviewing Al Brancato of the A's the other
day,
and he said that there was a ruling in effect in 1945 that players returning from the service had to be kept by the parent club only 30 days.
Yeah, that's right.
But then by the spring of 1946, that had been extended to a year.
Yes, they had to keep them a year.
Now, how about you and Mr. Grabner? How did you work it? How did you decide what players to keep, the holdovers? And what
I just kept what I thought was the best 25. And the rest of them, I figured wouldn't be any good to me, so I just didn't have to keep them. They sent them down into the minor. We sent them down into the minor leagues, and they got their major league salary.
I see.
Which covered up the fact that you had to keep them. We didn't keep them. They got their major league salary in the minor leagues for the rest of that year,
mm-hmm.
which caused, I might say, no inconvenience because a lot of guys got major league salaries that didn't belong in the major leagues.
I see. Do you wish to comment on any of the players of those wartime teams, guys like Thurman Tucker, Eddie Lopad, Edgar Smith, Gordon Maltzberger?
Smitty? Oh, he played good ball for me. We had a couple. We had one, Johnny Dickshot, and he was a good hitter. And we had a guy named Guy Cartwright that came with us. He was a good hitter.
Mm-hmm.
We had a pretty good team for war team and everything else, but the rest of them were in the service, of course. And then the following spring, when the war was over, I had 65 guys in mm-hmm. spring training. I had the biggest,
two teams.
Yeah, I had enough ball players to start a leg of my own. And I had to cut down to 25 by the 15th of May.
Mm-hmm.
I kept 30 of them till about the 15th of May, and then I had to cut five more. But as I say, they went to the minor leagues,
mm-hmm.
and they got their major league salary, which was in the letter of the law. Mm-hmm. We had to pay them. We couldn't keep them because we had a 25-player limit.
I see. Do any members of the opposition stand out in your mind? Do any members of the opposition stand out in your mind?
Not during the war,
Pete
no.
Gray,
I wouldn't.
Or...
Pete Gray was a pretty good outfielder, believe it or not. He was amazing. Mm-hmm. You watch him catch that ball with one hand, throw it up in the air, drop the glove and throw the ball in. Mm-hmm. And he could throw fairly well. But they found out that they pitched to him, they pitched low to him. And he couldn't hit the ball down. So he pitched the ball up, he could hit it pretty well on
so that
arm.
That was the secret then.
Yeah.
Came out,
then
the
that, well, that's what killed him. They could start pitch low to him, and he couldn't get the bat down there fast enough.
I say, what do you remember about Sig Jakuki?
Who?
Sig Jakuki.
Oh, that's the big guy with the Browns. He was the leader in that fight that night under the dugout, yeah.
I see.
He had a hold of Cuccinella, Tony Cuccinella, and I thought he was going to throw him up against the concrete, but he just dropped him. He was quite a guy. Pretty good pitcher, too.
Was he?
Yes, he was a pretty good pitcher. Mm-hmm. But he was a bad boy. He's out on nights a lot, I know that.
Fine. Anything else you'd like to comment on?
There's nothing I can tell you about that war teams except that we just put up. We didn't have what you call real good ball clubs. None of them did,
mm-hmm.
And all the good ball players were in the service. Of course, they were in the service, and all they were doing were playing ball in there. See,
mm-hmm.
Most of them, a lot of them were in the Air Force. Bertie Tebbets managed one of those teams in the Air Force. He had quite a few guys, including Phil Rizzuto, one of them, and Bill Dickey.
Mm-hmm.
He was, and Johnny Rigney, my pitcher, was there. He hurt his arm, and he never came back.
I think he
back.
Was out in the islands playing mm-hmm. exhibitions.
He was in Honolulu.
Yeah.
He came back. He couldn't throw.
Mm-hmm.
His arm never got well after that. Hurt it in the service and never could get his arm back.
George Case, the Washington outfielder, I interviewed him 2 weeks ago, and he said that owners like Comiskey, Griffith, Jerry Nugent, and so on were not by nature wealthy men. In other words, their take at the ballpark determined their fortunes,
whether
they were rich or poor.
That's right.
Do you remember any instances during the war when things got particularly tight and the paychecks were held up? Or?
No, none were, ever.
I see.
No, everybody got paid on time, first and 15th. I have no recollection whatever of any ball players ever complaining about not getting their pay.
Well, one final question, and that is, do you know the story behind Hank Baroyes being waived out of the American League? He had won 10 games by midseason. It seems strange that the Yankees would let him go.
Yeah, out of the American League? That wasn't Hank Baroyes. It was a pitcher, wasn't it?
Well, it was Hank Baroyes, who was a pitcher. And then he went on to win 11 games for the Cubs and pitched the Cubs to the pen.
Oh, yeah, Baroyes, yes.
Right.
Well, that's
a strange deal.
No, there's nothing strange about it at all. He was a great pitcher for the Yankees. He was winning.
Uh-huh.
He had a good record with the Yankees. Now, we got, as managers, what they call a waiver list.
Yeah.
8 or 9 ball players on it. Well, you look at it, and here's Hank Baroyes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know you're not going to get him, so you don't claim him. And that's what happened in the American League. All 8 clubs had a shot at him, but nobody figured that the Yankees would let him go. So they didn't claim him, so they get waivers on him. Now they turn around and sell him to the Cubs. And
they make
course,
a profit.
Yeah.
Well, why would they want to get rid of him anyway?
I don't know. I've never found out why they wanted to get rid of him, except maybe to make some money, and they made plenty.
Yeah.
They got Baroyes, and he was a good pitcher.
In those days, if I'm not mistaken, you could put a man on the waiver list, see how much he'd go for on the cash market, and then withdraw him, right?
When you put a man on the waiver list, if you were trying to get rid of him, the waivers would come in. They had 72 hours on him.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of 72 hours, we'd look at it and see who claimed him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we didn't want to let him go, we'd recall. Well, we could put him on waivers 5 or 6 times in those years.
Mm-hmm.
And unless we wanted, we might be talking to you about him. Well, if you claimed him, then 1 or 2 other clubs claimed him, and they were below you. They had the shot at him. So we'd just recall waivers. We'd keep him now. Finally, if they get to the point where you're the only one claimed him, now we'd give him to you. But as long as anybody else claimed him, we'd just recall. We wouldn't get him at all.
Or I'll sell him to the club that bid the
high. You couldn't sell him if you didn't get waivers.
Oh, I see.
No, you had to get waivers. You couldn't sell him until you got waivers.
Oh, I see.
Like Barori, they got waivers on him in all the 8 American League clubs.
The reason you passed on him is because you didn't think the Yankees would let him
go. No, I'm just like seven others. None of us thought they'd let Barori go. So we waved on him.
Okay.
No, and they sent him over to the Cubs.
I understand.
Now,
it seems strange to me that a pitcher of his quality, you know, would be.
That's right,
up.
But
I understand why.
You put yourself in our spot. You see him, you want him,
yeah.
But you know you can't get him, so you don't claim him. There's no use bothering claiming. Claim somebody else on there that you might think would help you, but claim Barori just a waste of time. They'd recall, and that's it.
So
of course, the only thing that could have done was to stop him. Hold him up. Somebody claimed him. Hold him up, and they couldn't sell him to the Cubs. But nobody thought of that. They never thought they'd let him go. And that's how he got out of the American League.
So theoretically, in those days, you could put your whole team on waivers.
Yeah, you could put the whole. Well, used to come home 10, 15 guys on there.
When was this business stop? I know it's not like that now. It's not like that now, is it? I mean, when a guy goes on waivers.
Yeah, you can put him on, but you can only recall him twice.
Oh, I see.
Third time he goes on, he goes.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, they changed the rule.
I see.
You got only twice. Now you can recall him twice. The third time, if you put him on again and somebody claims him, there's no out in the matter. You have to let him go.
I see.
So we get a guy that you claim twice, and he's a pretty good ball player. And the third, he don't go on the third time. He never makes it again.